Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. Today's topic is one that I think touches the lives of all of us on many different levels. And it is the subject of Alzheimer's. We have a guest with us today, Gary Reiswig, who's written a book that I think is extremely powerful. It's called The Thousand Mile Stare. Now, Alzheimer's is a topic that so many people will discuss. I know of many, many families that have been touched by this physiological condition affecting the brain and the nervous system. But Gary's story enters into a whole new level with this particular disease that only recently has been discovered. We're going to hear his story in just a moment. Gary, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna.
Now, Garrett, your formal name, is it, it's not Gerard, is it?
No, my mother named me Gary, I believe, after Gary Cooper, whom she admired, so.
Hey, I like
so
that.
That's
always, that's a good one to follow.
Yes.
Now, you have been involved with farming because that was part of your family's legacy. You've also...
Yes, I grew up on the farm and really worked with my dad until he was nearly 20. So.
And then you were a preaching man. You've been a community organizer. You've also been involved as an innkeeper, a real estate agent. You've had quite a unique life path that you have followed. But the most passionate subject matter that you're involved with is Alzheimer's right now, and at the beginning of your book, in the foreword, is a physician by the name of Thomas D. Bird, who's a professor, neurology and medical genetics, department of the University of Washington, which is in my part of the world, the VA Puget Sound Healthcare System here in the Seattle area. And he said, your story, your family's story, is a significant one. He's interacted with your family for over 25 years, and that your family has a mutation in one of three genes known to cause early-onset familial Alzheimer's disease. Go into that subject matter a little bit before we go into some of your personal aspects with the family. What is this in this research that has evolved, and when did it get discovered?
Okay, our family first became involved in research in the 1970s, after we heard in the 1960s that my father and some of his siblings were developed what a doctor at the University of Oklahoma Medical Center called Alzheimer's disease. It was such a strange sounding name then. We had never heard of it, and I presume 99% of the citizens of the world had never heard of this disease, and maybe many physicians had not even heard of it. But when it was realized by one of my aunts, who was married to my father's brother, and when her husband got this disease in his early 40s and started to be unable to work, she got active and got the family involved in research, and first with the University of Colorado. And then eventually, when the Congress of the United States recognized the severity of the approaching Alzheimer's disease problem as people became more informed about it, they passed legislation, and through the National Institute of Health, established the Alzheimer's Disease Research Centers, and one of those centers was at the University of Seattle, and Dr. Bird was one of the members of that team at the University of Washington, and they had designed a study of familial early onset or genetic Alzheimer's, and they were interested in our family because it was such a large family with so many cases of the disease. They recruited us for their study, and so that's where this whole research began in 1985.
This is such a poignant book, and I've recommended it to a number of people that have been dealing with issues like this, and some of them haven't had this as a consistent problem in the family. But let's go back with your family, because part of what evolved with your family was this awareness, and primarily because of your aunt. She really was one of these people. She wasn't going to be the silent generation. She got really, really very vocal. In fact, there were members of your family that were downright upset with her because she wouldn't stay still. And she loved her husband a great deal, and she was going to definitely find out what was wrong with him. But let's go back to 1936. This really grabbed me right at the very beginning of your book, and it was about your grandparents, John and Molly, and one of your uncles, Otto.
Yes.
Talk about that situation, because that is the earliest your family was able to go back, for sure.
Yes,
to
that
record
this is true. Well, that event came about in early January of 1936. When my grandfather and grandmother and this one of my uncles, who was then 17, left their farm in the Blue Mound community of Oklahoma, headed just across the Texas state line to a little town named Booker, where they often took their produce, you know, eggs and cream, which they sold and then could buy other supplies that they weren't able to grow. And on a clear day where you could see forever, that old saying from The Sound of Music, I guess, at this railroad crossing near Huntoon, Texas, my granddad inexplicably drove in front of a freight train, and my grandmother was killed. And nobody could explain it. I mean, the family was aware that Granddad was a little forgetful at that point. That's the way they described him. But they just didn't realize the severity then of what was affecting him. And then afterward, when he continued to get worse and became unable to care for himself and became unable to speak and all of those things that happened, that we now know happened with Alzheimer's, it was still... They just attributed it to the grief over what he had done and over his wife's death. And so it wasn't then until my father's generation, when my granddad's children began to come down with the same symptoms that granddad had, that this aunt and maybe a few others woke up and said, hey, this is really a serious problem. This is a family problem. And that kicked us into the research. Well, my Aunt Esther literally dragged, prayed, cajoled, sometimes scolded the family, you know, to get us, to get everybody involved. And most did. Most gave their blood, and when the research really began seriously in 1985, most of the family was on board.
You do a wonderful job in your book of going into the history of Alzheimer's and how it actually was discovered. You talk about this wonderful doctor who was able to describe one of his patients, who was a 51-year-old woman, Frau Auguste Decker, and this was in 1901. Tell us about this, because this is tremendous history.
Well, this history of Dr. Alzheimer's identification of what became known as Alzheimer's disease is now especially interesting to us because there is now mounting evidence that Frau D had the same genetic mutation as our family and the other Volga German families who were involved in the University of Washington research. And I can go into more detail about that, but just let me talk for a moment to your original question about Dr. Alzheimer and his patient, Frau D. She was confined to an asylum for what was called the Asylum for the Mentally Ill and Epileptics.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a crude name by today's standards of medical practice, but that's what they called it. And he was the primary physician in that hospital, and she was put there because her family could no longer take care of her. She would leave the house unsupervised and walk through the streets of Frankfurt, Germany, where the family lived, and shout at people, and she was shouting at people, she was also very paranoid, afraid of people, and she looked unkempt, she couldn't care for herself anymore, and the family was unable to keep her supervised, and they finally put her in this asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that Dr. Alzheimer first examined her, and he described her symptoms and called her condition presenile dementia. And then 5 years later, when she died, Dr. Alzheimer had actually moved away from Frankfurt, but he got permission from her family to examine her brain, and the brain was shipped to where he was then living in another city in Germany. And he took slices and used a brand new silver staining technique to look at the cells of her brain, and that's where he observed what he described as the plaques and tangles. And those plaques and tangles remain today as the clinical description of Alzheimer's. The plaques are composed of beta amyloid protein, and the tangles are made up of a protein called tau. And that is still today the clinical description of Alzheimer's.
It's fascinating information. Here this was discovered early 1900, over 100 years ago. And only, you know, since your family really got involved with this research starting in 85, were they able to expand on this to be able to say there's got to be some way of taking care of this. So here you have this situation, and then your own dad was affected by this. And the story about your dad, who in my mind's view was actually almost a genius because of the way he could solve problems. But in your family, this started at a young age. And I can remember years ago when I was talking with a very dear friend whose dad had Alzheimer's, her telling me about how she would go visit the Alzheimer's ward, and she was amazed at how many young people were in there. She said you would think, as she had thought, it would be the older people's disease, but she knew a young man who was just 32 years of age that had Alzheimer's, and her father, who was in there, was in his 70s. She said it broke her heart. She said, people have no idea that this is a disease that can affect anybody of any age. So tell us about your dad, and how old was he when this hit him?
Well, I would say, in retrospect, I could see problems emerging when he was in his early to mid-40s. Those
mm-hmm.
were problems that mainly had to do with making decisions. Then those problems expanded into being disorganized, getting lost when he would go to a familiar town. to maintain machinery. He had various implement companies that he dealt with, and sometimes he would go to one of these places and be unable to find his way home. And Mother and I would be doing chores, wondering where he was, and then finally he would arrive, and Mother would ask him, "Well, where have you been?" He said, "Well, I don't know. I got a little lost coming home from Follett." You know, it was where it was a area he knew well, you know, from his childhood on, and then he just started to become unable to remember. Yes, go ahead.
How many siblings did your dad have?
There were 14 in his generation, 7 boys and 7 girls.
Wow.
And he was number 4 in the order of birth.
Mm-hmm.
And out of those 14, it came to be that 10 had inherited the mutated gene on chromosome 1 that causes the familial early onset Alzheimer's in our family and the other Volga German families that were in the Dr. Bird study. The age of onset is quite early in many of these families, although it does vary somewhat. But in our family, it was early, usually onset in by the mid-40s and death in the mid to late 50s.
Well, with the time that this was affecting, you think back to your grandparents and to your dad. And those time frames, people were not speaking up. Somebody acted a little odd, well, you just took it in stride.
That's
and
right.
And you just
it was
dealt
called
with
hardening
it
of the arteries, or he's a little wacky, or you know. But people in my granddad's generation were not living as long. It was my father's generation where finally people started living long enough where the symptoms could be easily noticed. And Alzheimer's, frankly, is mainly a disease of the aging, of aging, of getting older. But what we're talking about in these cases of familial early onset Alzheimer's, this is a rare form of the disease where it's in, where there is a genetic anomaly that is causing it. But generally, most cases of Alzheimer's are in people over 65 or 70.
Mm-hmm.
Although we are seeing more frequently the early onset, more cases are being identified, I think, is what the truth of the matter is. As the public is more aware of the issue, more cases are being identified, and doctors are making the diagnosis earlier and earlier as they have become aware that it is a problem. But many of those cases, most of those cases, are not the genetic form, but are caused from other unknown causes that are just being worked on now, that are being figured out.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it is particular proteins that are causing these conditions in the brain, we don't know what activates this. We have no clue, really. We have little concepts, but we haven't been able to really get down to the bare bones. However, you do bring out the fact that a gene mutates, and so whatever triggers this particular mutation, it's not the familial type of a situation, but it is really something, and DNA is a way of checking on this, which I think is significant for anyone that maybe has had something like this in the family that's occurred, and they go, well, gee whiz, we ought to have this checked out. Is that a good idea to do?
Well, if people are seeing a frequent pattern of any kind of illness or any problem that seems to be repeating itself in generations, that those individuals probably do need to see a doctor and get a referral to some kind of genetic program to see if the history can be checked out in any more systematic way. But I wouldn't really encourage people to run out and start just randomly seeking genetic testing. I know there are some tests sort of being publicly or frequently advertised to test for Alzheimer's disease. But this is a totally different thing than we're talking about here, where we're talking about the genetics of inheriting a mutated gene that causes the disease. So just back to the original point, if a family is seeing frequent and repeated cases of senility or any other health problem, they should check with the doctor and perhaps look into it to see if some history and some traces of it can be tracked down.
I think we are, and it will be definitely a part of the medical environment within probably 25 years, where a lot of things will be made available in the way of information that we couldn't have even dreamed that we could have had. I've been talking about this for over 20 years, where someone will take a drop of blood. This could be with a baby. It can be with an adult, and be able to give a good readout on the probability of perhaps health challenges and this type of thing. And that's part of what this evolution in research is developing. And I just think your family has been able to give us such a wonderful service. Now, you found that you did not inherit the gene. There is a drawing out the pedigree of your family background, and how many, there were certain ones of you that did not have the gene carried forward, and that's just one of the quirks of Mother Nature.
Well, yes. This gene that runs in our family is called an autosomal dominant gene. And what that means in practical terms is that each child of an affected parent has a 50-50 chance of inheriting the gene. You either get it or you don't. It's like a genetic coin flip. And in my immediate family, there were three of us. And unfortunately, my older sister and younger brother both inherited the gene, and it skipped me. So that was just the way it turned out in my immediate family. In my father's generation, of course, it was sort of an unlucky generation. 10 out of 14 got the gene. In the generation of my cousins, it seems like we're a little under 50% in that generation. So things tend to, I guess, even out over, just keep flipping that coin, and you flip the people flip the coin every time they have a baby.
One of your relatives that you had a chance to talk with, and the name is escaping me right now, one of your relatives has traveled speaking before groups trying to raise the awareness of the disease because he's been diagnosed with it. And I was intrigued with the fact that an Alzheimer's patient or someone told him, if you smoke, you're going to not have as much of a problem. And so before he'd give a talk, he'd always go out and have a cigarette. And he didn't like smoking, but there was something in the nicotine that affected the brain. Tell us about that story. And which relative was that?
Well, this is my cousin Chuck. And he is really my generation's hero, as Aunt Esther was my father's generation hero. Chuck is the only member of our family who knew he was in line to possibly inherit the gene, who decided to take the test to find out if he had the gene before the symptoms of the disease developed. And when he went and got the test and went through the counseling that was required to do this kind of genetic testing, and he was told that, yes, in fact, he did have the gene, He then, of course, knew he would get the disease. That was when he said, you know, I will not go to my grave being quiet about this. I am going to speak out. I am going to say what's on my mind. I want to do what I can to promote awareness of this disease, to keep the research humming, because I want a cure for the next generation, for my daughter's generation and those that will come after her. And he now has a grandchild. And but on to your comment about the smoking. This is not an excuse for smoking. Smoking is bad for the brain. We all know that. But, however, what researchers had noticed when they were doing research on mice, they found out that they could temporarily improve the memory of mice that had been purposely infected with a mutated gene causing Alzheimer's disease in mice. If they blew nicotine smoke into the mice's habitat, they were able to recall what they had been taught before they were affected with Alzheimer's disease. And Chuck read this, and he had been a smoker, frankly, when he, in his younger days, but he had quit. Mm-hmm. But when he read about this, when he would go on speaking engagements, he found if he did sneak out and have a cigarette right before he spoke, that he felt sharper. He felt like his memory was temporarily improved. It certainly wasn't creating a cure. It was just stimulating the synapses of the cells in his brain to temporarily work more efficiently.
So wouldn't it be amazing if in tobacco, for all of the negatives of tobacco in today's world, wouldn't it be amazing if they were able to extrapolate from that a particular molecule that would be able to assist the
brain would power. Be amazing. And there are actually now a worldwide throughout the United States and Europe and all over the world, there are more than 750 research projects being worked on right now. And I'm sure that that is one of them that you just described. That is why there is quite a bit of optimism about this disease for the future, because so many good scientists are studying this disease, studying how it works, testing various substances and creations, compounds, to see what effect it has on the workings of the disease. So there's a lot of energy and money being put into this, and hopefully someday in the not too far future, we will have some effective treatments.
Well, Gary, your book, The Thousand Mile Stare, I think is not only written extremely well, but I think the information regarding the scientific research, what is going on, your personal story, your family's history, putting all of this out there, talking about Chuck, bringing this information forward, I think is just absolutely marvelous. It is, I think, a statement about today's world, how instead of being the silent generation, we're the generation that says, tell us what we can do. Let's ask questions. Your Aunt Esther is a woman that, you know, just going before Congress in her time frame was a tremendous step forward as a woman.
Yes, it was.
It was just amazing. Do you have a website regarding your book?
Yes. The website for the book with all kinds of information and links to it is thethousandmilestare.com.
Now, is that the word thousand-mile stare or the number thousand?
I'll just spell it out. It's thethousandmilestare.com.
Thethousandmilestare.com. Well, Gary, this has just been wonderful. I'm so delighted that you were able to be on the show with me today. Your book I have recommended to people. I will continue to recommend to people.
Thank you very much.
I think that when you can talk as honestly and as compassionately and as effectively and as informatively as you have in this book, this is a plus all the way down the line. For the layperson that has no idea but knows of families that are being affected with this, remember, Alzheimer's can be with someone as young as 28. I have dear friends that have members in their family that, my goodness, are anywhere from 50 up to 80. This is something that, because we are living longer, we need to be informed about, and we need to be unafraid of looking at it for the reality that it is. Gary Reiswig has been my guest. His last name is spelled R-E-I-S-W-I-G. Good reading, The Thousand Mile Stare. Check it out. It is really worth it. And check out his website, thethousandmilestare.com. This is Donna Sebo. Thanks again, Gary, for being my guest. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Those telephone lines have now been opened up for you. 888-815-9756 is our toll-free worldwide telephone number. And you can call in from anywhere on this planet, and I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and of course, after that, I also like to know where you're calling in from. After that, then just sit back, relax, let me tell you what I perceive, and then if you have a question about anyone, any situation, any condition, doesn't make any difference, give me a call. You can ask about animals, you can ask about people that are thousands of miles away from you, it doesn't make any difference. I consider myself an information resource, and I'm delighted to be able to be available to you during this hour. Also, don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about Overcomers Incorporated. Do you like being inspired about people that have done something regardless of what situations they've been in? They've been able to stand up to whatever the challenges have been. Well, I do. I enjoy stories like that. Why? Because life is a tough proposition. Nobody gets through life experience without getting kicked in the teeth one way or the other, mentally, physically, emotionally, or spiritually. And it's always been something for me, for as far back as I can remember, wonderful to know about those people that dared to go on. They didn't get into their pity pots and wallow in them. They might give themselves a bit of time to cry and be sad, but they got themselves up and out. Well, that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. My guest is going to be Lynn Klepel, and we are going to have a good time with her. So I invite you to listen. And then, of course, on Memorial Day, we're going to be talking about, sooner or later, restoring sanity to the end of life care. Demonio Aikovosi. And lots of times we don't want to talk about things like this. I know it's a holiday, but I just thought, why not? This is something all of us are going to have to deal with, period. I mean, that's just a fact. We all come in with an expiration date. I haven't found anybody that's otherwise. If you know of somebody that's otherwise, let me know. I'd be interested. So the key is, how do you work towards that? And with so many people living to be more and more of ages, closer to 100, do you know of anybody that does? Well, this is information that's good to know. We've got a whole different generation of the way health is, and our knowledge and understanding, we're all going to be living a lot longer than our ancestors did. So just be aware, these are things to be thoughtful about so that you can take charge of your life and live it the way that you want it to be lived. Okay, and again, phone number to call in to is 888-815-9756. I wanted to share with you a fun story. The question was posed, what would you do with $1 million? Have you ever fantasized about that? Oh, what would I do with $1 million? Well, it's a lot of fun to do, and you really should do that exercise once in a while. $1 million in today's world isn't anything like it was in 1900, but it's still $1 million. What would you do if you had $1 million? Do you know that most people that win the lottery end up broke within 5 years, even if they've won $30 or $40 million. Why? Because they don't have an understanding of how to work with money and how to make money work for them. Well, I've got a story about a lady, Leslie Kappen. She ended up with $1 million. Yes, she did, but her story is really fun. And she is a lady that I think just shows how all of us make our choices based on what is right for us. And that is the way life should be. Well, Leslie is an interesting lady. She loved animals, and she had just the most wonderful husband, and he was a person that loved animals just as much as she did. Well, because she couldn't have children, her animals became a very, very special substitute, and she had a dear, dear animal friend, Mr. McGruff. And Mr. McGruff passed away eventually, and regrettably, because dogs, you know, don't have that long a lifespan. You're lucky if you're able to keep them for 15 to 20 years. So many of them die so many years younger than that. Well, she thought she had lost a child. This is just was very devastating to her, and for those of us that have lost pets, we know how emotional a situation that is. Well, one day after Mr. McGruff's passing, a very dear friend came by her house and gave her a gift, and it was this huge purse. Well, she just said, oh, this is so sweet of you, and went on and on and on. Well, she opened the purse. That's what we women do. How big is it on the inside? Does it have any
BBS Radio. BlakeRadio.com.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
A difficulty here. We had one of our Comcast lines go down. Comcast can be problematic for all of you out there tuning in. But we have had a Comcast system go down. So we're going to run a little music and promos right now, and hopefully we can get things going for you shortly. Stick around.
You're going to start taking this hemp, I say. Go to hempusa.org. You may not like what I'm about to say, but you know I'm gonna say it anyway. The government doesn't want the best for you. They keep you down, they keep you blue. They starve your body for all its nutrients. They won't let you grow industrial hemp. It really doesn't make any kind of sense when it's so healthy for the world and useful for you, my friends. I hope Mr. Bush will hear this song, for the heart of America wants this one. Go to hempusa.org. If you're a truther, an anarchist, or renegade, you only want things that God has made. Go to hempusa.org. We offer free shipping anywhere in the States. Go to hempusa.org.
Hey, this is Mickey from Aldo Rocks. You're listening to BBS Radio,
the number one internet radio network on the planet.
That's BBSRadio.com.
Hi, this is Donna. I'm so sorry that we've had an interruption here, but hey, we're back on and we're ready to go. I was telling you about this wonderful, wonderful lady, Leslie, and her gift that was given to her. And this is a little chihuahua, and oh, Can you imagine 2.5 pounds of total love inside of a purse that a friend gives you? Well, she had this instantaneous bond with this little creature. And his name was bigger than he was. He was called Dr. Papidis. And it was a variation on the Spanish name Pepito. Well, she said he was stealing and healing her heart, so that's why she gave him the additional honor of calling him Doctor. Well, they ended up shortening it to Dr. P. However, the little guy, as much as she instantaneously fell in love with him, she began to notice he didn't seem to want to have anything to drink or anything to eat. So he was watched very carefully by her, and he was just so loving and so affectionate, but she said, something's wrong with this dog. So the vet she took him to said, you know what, I think he's from a puppy mill, and I bet you he's got severe dehydration, and he's got an endocrine disorder, so he started talking about all these different things. Well, Leslie took this baby home, and between the injections of medicine this little guy was getting, she was feeding him with an eyedropper and giving him water. She'd cook rice for him to make sure his tummy could take whatever nutrition was in that rice water. Well, the little guy turned around. He was doing just fabulously. So she took him everywhere with her. She had gone through a very difficult time caring for this little tiny 2.5 pound ball of wonder. And she, doing the work that she did, the people that she was in close contact with, because she was working in a dermatologist's environment, the clients just absolutely loved this little character. And so she got him a little miniature white lab coat, and she'd get these little doggy stethoscopes that he could chew on and all kinds of stuff. Well, someone told her about a contest for the cutest dog, sponsored by a pet food manufacturer, and they said, oh, you've got to enter your dog. Your dog is just so precious, just so adorable. Well, she had all kinds of pictures, and finally she decided she was going to take one and got him all dressed up in a cute little jacket with sunglasses and this type of thing and send it off. Well, my goodness, there were over 60,000 entrants into this wonderful contest with animals, and she won the contest with her photo about Mr. P, or Dr. P. To her amazement, the prize was $1 million. They asked her, what are you going to do with all of that money? Are you going to keep working? Where are you going to go on vacation? She said, none of the above. I want to help other animals. So she split the prize, the $1 million she got, between the Denver Dumb Friends League, which is a haven for homeless pets, and the Max Fund, which is a no-kill shelter. Each of these get $500,000 spread out over 30 years. Can you imagine gifting that to organizations? And the people running these organizations were just absolutely blown away, because that gave them something for their budget. And if any of you have ever been around any of these shelters that have been put together to save animals from euthanization, you know how dedicated these people are, and this was just a godsend to both of these groups. Well, she got a lot of criticism from people. They said, you're crazy. You could be living in the lap of luxury. Why are you doing this? And she said, it's because of this wonderful little person that was gifted to me, Dr. P. I never imagined that after beating the odds physically of him surviving, the little fellow, because I took a picture of him, enabled me to win $1 million. And she said, I decided I was going to take that $1 million and make it a gift that keeps on giving. And she said, so other people may have the opportunity that I've had, and that animals have the opportunities that they should have. An incredible story. Now, this is information about the Cutest Pet Contest. There are gift cards they give out, cash, and all you have to do is go to at thecutestpetcontest.com. thecutestpetcontest.com, at thecutestpetcontest.com. Also, the American Humane Society, you can go to AmericanHumane.org. They have its Pets and Pals photo contest every summer, and they have a $1,000 giveaway. And every month, there is another chance to win $1,000 at the Great American Photo Contest.com. They like just funny, wild, and wacky snapshots. But there are three opportunities. If you're a pet lover and you know about that special, special animal that is going to make a difference, and you think that your photo might entitle you to that wonderful opportunity of winning some money, hey, why not submit it? I think it is a great idea. It's a wonderful thing. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756 is the toll-free number if you'd like to call in and chat with me. We're going to be going to the top of the hour. I was doing some homework. I have a series of children's books that I'm wanting to put out, and I thought, you know, this story, this one story that I've got, it's called A Woodcutter in the Tree, I'd really like to find out about the oldest trees in the world. Well, I came up from the internet on Wikipedia, my gracious, just all kinds of trees. And the oldest one, which was cut down in 1964, was 5,000 years old. And it was a Great Basin bristle cone pine. And then when I went through the list, which was pages long, there is a particular tree called Old Rasmus that was in Sweden. And at the time, I believe that Old Rasmus was cut down, he was 9,500 years old. I mean, this is just incredible. Now, there is a tree called Pando. They call it a clonal tree. Now, this is some information that I never had a clue about. You see a tree, you say, okay, it grows, it can be like the giant sequoia, it'll live, and then one day it's going to die. Well, apparently, clonal trees are different. They are not unlike long-lived plant and fungal species, so no individual part of a clonal colony is alive in the sense of an active metabolism for more than a very small fraction of the life of the entire clone. Now, some of these clonal colonies, may be fully connected via their root systems, while most are not actually interconnected, but are genetically identical clones, which populate an area through vegetative reproduction. Now, what they have here is an estimate, and this is for this clonal tree. Now, it's called a Pando, and this one, if you can imagine, to the best of their guesstimates, is 80,000 to a million years old. That old. It's a species of a quaken aspen, and it's located in Utah. That's right, in Utah. And it covers 107 acres of land. It has about 47,000 stems on it, and each of the stems, an average, they say, is about 130 years old, and they continually die. The stems die every 130 years, and they're renewed by the roots. And the best that they'll be able to evaluate at this time, they say it's the heaviest known organism, weighing over 6,000 tons. 6,000 tons. Absolutely amazing. And they just go under different places in Sweden and all over the place. Now, Prometheus, which is the tree that I found that's a Great Basin bristlecone pine, I don't know why, but I thought it was going to be this great big expansive tree. But when I saw the grove that it grew in, it wasn't as big as I expected it was going to be. But the stump of the tree, which was cut, that was just absolutely amazing, and I've got a picture of it in front of me. And it was a pretty good size stump. So out of curiosity, I decided, you know, I think I'm going to research the oak tree, because oaks are very slow growing. And I thought, okay, we have an oak tree that's in our backyard that, oh my goodness, it was cut back about 35 years ago. And it was not very big. And in the years that since it's been, it was cut, it was topped, by golly, that tree has only grown about 15 feet. And I thought, what is the oldest oak? Well, the oldest angel oak, that's the name of it, angel oak, is in Johns Island, South Carolina. And they say reportedly the oldest thing, living or man-made, east of the Rockies, angel oak is a live oak tree aged approximately 1,500 years. And they just call it the tree in South Carolina. And it stands in a wooded area along Bohicket Road of Johns Island outside of Charleston, South Carolina. And they say the attraction is this single tree standing in a park, so you just need to look out for it. It's native to that area of country. It isn't very tall, but it has this phenomenal canopy. And they say lumber from the live oak forests and the Sea Islands was really big business in the 18th and 19th centuries. And this oak, called angel oak, and you can look it up on Wikipedia, you will find out that it was part of an Abraham Waite 1717 land grant. And he owned a lot of plantations, Mr. Waite did. And the city of Charleston now owns this magnificent tree, no charge to view it, and they recommend that if ever you have a chance to visit Charleston, South Carolina, you need to see it. Now, it's over 65 feet high, and it would have sprouted 1,000 years before Columbus arrived in the New World, and the recorded history traces the ownership of the live oak and surrounding land back again to the year 1717, when Abraham Waite received it as part of a small land grant. So it has a diameter spread of 160 feet, a circumference of nearly 25 feet, and covers 17,100 square feet of ground. Amazing. Well, this is Donna Sebo. You never know what you're going to find out. Learn something new every day. This is Donna Sebo. I'm so delighted that you were able to join me today. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you might be on this planet of ours. Remember, always you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna. We'll be back with you tomorrow talking about people, individuals that make a difference in life just like you do. Be the best you can. It does count. This is Donna. We'll be talking with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.